All right, so good morning, everybody. It's nice and early. My name is James McNellis. I'm a software developer on the Visual C++ team at Microsoft. I work on our core libraries, so our C and C++ standard libraries, mostly our C standard library. And I'm going to talk a bit today about sort of a whirlwind introduction to the basics of C++ for C-sharp developers, talking about a few C++ fundamentals for writing high-quality C++ code, and then discuss a few options for interoperating between C++ and C-sharp. So to start off with, you know, why bother with C++ at all? And I think the core reason is that C++ has a very useful union of features. So it has high-level abstractions, things like templates and generic programming and classes and encapsulation and inheritance. But all of these are specified in such a way that they map very well to actual hardware. So the compiler is able to do a really good job of optimizing those things to run very fast on hardware. This isn't a unique feature of C++. There are many other systems programming languages that offer high-level abstractions, but C++ is certainly the most popular of them. So with that said, you know, why bother with using C++ from C sharp? And there's a number of reasons that we came up with. These are broad areas that when we talk to people, this is why people do it. That oftentimes we have legacy code that's written in C++ and we want to reuse it, so core business logic or core components that we want to use across multiple platforms that may not all support C sharp. Certainly now that C sharp is coming to other platforms, maybe some of those reasons are less important nowadays, but it's still to a certain degree important. You may also want to take advantage of existing C++ libraries or C libraries. There are many out there that can solve practically any problem. C is the lingua franca of programming. You may want to take advantage of the performance offered by C++. So C sharp can produce fairly performant code. Certainly there have been a lot of new innovations with that recently with the new JIT that's been implemented in the CLR. With the new native .NET, I believe it's called, where they actually take CLI code and run it through our C++ backend. And finally, I would argue that we should all start using C++ because it actually is a really great language to be programming in. I did C sharp for a couple of years as a member of the Visual Studio team working on the XAML tooling, and ended up switching back to C++. That's really where my passion is. So we'll look at two things today. The first is C++ fundamentals, and then we'll look at interop options like I discussed before. I want to start, though, with an example of what is not C++. So this is actually code. This would compile with a C++ compiler. So technically, yes, it's C++ code. But really, it's just C code in disguise. We don't actually want to write C++ code that looks like this anymore. Don't even think about that. We have a lot of, we have manual memory management here. We have to worry about, making sure we clean up after ourselves. This kind of code gets very messy very quickly. It's very common in legacy components. So, C++ has been around for a long time, so there's certainly a lot of code that looks like this. But in new code, there's better ways to do it, and so that's what we're going to look at first. The most important recommendation I'll make, though, is I can't discuss nearly everything, so I strongly recommend, if you're going to do, any serious C++ development, to get a good book. One of the most dangerous features of C++ and C#, I think, is that they look a lot alike. They both use braces, they have, new, they work with different types. So they look very similar, but, the actual semantics of what the code does is very different. So this happens to be a very good book. It covers, it was recently updated, I think, 2 years ago to cover the latest improvements made to C++. It's a primer in the sense that it goes through all the basics, but, as experienced programmers, we can easily skim over the, here's what a for loop does, and, skip to the meat of this is how C++ actually works under the covers. So in the abstract of the talk, I said that I wanted to cover common pitfalls. And the biggest pitfall, like I said, is that people often look at C++ and say, it looks very similar to C#. It works very similar to C#. And that's not the case. So I think we should start from the beginning and ask, what is an object? And that might sound like a very simple question. So here is the simplest object that I could come up with. we have an integer, it's a local variable, and it's x. So this is actually an object in C++. We can do some operations with it. So, you know, we can take that x, which is initialized to 0. We can make a copy of it named y, and so now we have two ints. And we can also assign from the value of x to y. Now, you know, you're probably looking at this and saying, well, of course, this is how programming works. But the important thing is not that this works for ints, but this is exactly how it works for classes as well. So if you have a class type, you can, you know, initialize an instance of your class. The braces here just mean initialize it. The empty braces mean that we'll default initialize it. When we have another object in the braces, it means we'll make a copy of that object. So just like with the int, we can make copies, and we can assign from one instance of an object to another. So there are four special operations that we'll talk about for any given type. These names are specific to classes, but the concepts apply equally to built-in types like integers and floating-point numbers. Construction, copy construction, which is a special case of construction, but it's an important special case. Copy assignment, and destruction. So if we go back to our int, we have construction, where we construct an integer x from a set of arguments. You know, for int, obviously, you know, you can just construct it from another int. We can copy it, and so this is what we'll call copy construction. When we instantiate y, we can assign from one to the other, and then we can destroy them. And for integers, there's no destruction required. But for class types, it's all exactly the same. So for class types, we can construct an object, we can copy an object, we can assign from one object to another, and then we can destroy them. And for class for built-in types like integers, all of these operations are well-defined. Like when you initialize from a value, it actually stores that value in memory to set that. When you assign from one to the other, it copies the bits representing, you know, the one integer into the other integer. For classes, all of these operations can be customized. And they're customized through a set of special member functions. So here's an example of my class. This first operation is the default constructor. It looks like a default constructor in C#. Nothing particularly special about it. The second is the destructor. And this is called whenever the object is destroyed. Object lifetimes are always deterministic in C++, so you always specify exactly when objects are created and destroyed, and we'll take a look at that in a moment. The third is the copy constructor. So it's a constructor that takes another instance of the same type, and this is used to copy from one instance of an object to another. And then the third is the assignment operator, and this is used for assigning one instance of an object to the other object. Now, the difference between copy construction and assignment is, in copy construction, the target object doesn't exist yet. You're initializing a new object from another object. With assignment, the object already exists. So if we go back to our example here, in assignment, the y object already exists. It's already been initialized. And so that's the difference between the two. So are there any questions about this so far? All right. So objects have a couple of other properties. So every object basically is just an array of bytes in memory, and it has a type that specifies how those bytes are interpreted. You can take the address of an object, which is its location in memory, and that gives you a pointer to that object. And in C++, we use an asterisk to specify this is a pointer to that type of object. So here we initialize p to be a pointer to x. We use the ampersand operator to take the address of an object. Every object has its own address. So for example, if we declare, you know, my class two instances x and y, and we get pointers to them, those pointers will not be equal. There's a special pointer value, null putter. Sometimes it's spelled with all caps, N-U-L-L. The null putter is the new C++11 way of spelling this. And this indicates that the pointer doesn't point anywhere, so it's like null in C#, for reference types. And it's important to note that pointers are just objects too. So, you know, a pointer is just, you know, a set of bytes, and it has a type. It's a pointer type that says how those bytes are interpreted. And so for those pointer types, we can also copy those, we can assign those, we can deal with them like any other object type. So the key point here is that, like, we're just dealing with objects, and there's nothing special particularly about classes or pointers or ints. They're all the same kind of thing. They're all object types. the unique thing here compared to C sharp is that in C sharp, you know, indirection is mostly implicit. So if you have value types, you know, for example, here, you know, X and Y are distinct objects or are distinct entities. So when we change the value of Y here, you know, we're not changing the value of X as well. But for reference types, you know, there's no hint in the source code that says, oh, these two things actually refer to the same object. They denote the same object. So for example, with this list example at the bottom, when we add a new element to list X, it's also adding it to list Y because both X and Y are references to the same object. This is not the case in C++. So in C++, there's always the indirection is always explicit. So there's always an asterisk there to imply that it's a pointer, or an ampersand to denote a reference, and we'll look at those in a moment. Or in some cases, you know, a class may encapsulate some indirection, but the indirection will still be explicit within that class definition. So here's a particular example of this, where we have an integer x initialized to 0. We obtain a pointer to it, and then we can change the value of x via the pointer, but it's very clear that there's indirection here and that we have reference semantics through the pointer. Similarly, the same example works for class types. There's nothing special about class types, like I said. They work the same way. So every object has a lifetime, which is basically from the moment the object comes into existence, or is constructed for classes, to the point at which the object goes out of existence, or is destructed or destroyed. Lifetime is associated with storage duration, which is basically the period of time during which the bytes in which it's represented are actually used to represent that object. And there's four different classes of storage duration, and I've grouped them into three. The first is automatic storage duration, then there's static and thread local storage duration, and then there's dynamic storage duration. So everything we've looked at so far has been automatic storage duration, or they're basically just local variables. These come into existence when the variable is declared, and then they go out of existence when the block in which they are declared is exited. So here, for example, you can see that x comes into existence where it's declared, and it goes out of existence at the end of the function, and the same for y. The nice thing here is that the lifetimes nest very nicely. So you'll note that the lifetime of y is always a subset of the lifetime of x, and this is a very useful feature of automatic variables, as we'll see in a moment. So for static storage duration, they're basically global variables. There's two different forms. One of them is, you know, just an ordinary global variable at, you know, global scope or in a namespace. These are initialized. They come into existence when the program starts, before any of your other code starts to run. Generally, of course, we should avoid global state, but sometimes it's necessary. There's also function local statics, which are basically static variables within a function. And these come into existence when a function is first called. So the first time that f is called, the constructor will get run for this, and then it will exist until the end of the program, just like other globals. I will note one thing, that initialization used to not be thread safe, so C++ didn't actually have a concept of threads until 2011, when C++ 11 was standardized. And in the latest release of Visual Studio, Visual Studio 2013, it's still not thread safe. In the next release, it will be thread safe. So if you have multiple threads using functions with function local statics, you'll need to be very careful. So the third is dynamic storage duration. So sometimes we need the scope. We don't want to use a global, but we also need to be able to access an object from outside of, you know, a particular scope. So an automatic variable is not sufficient. And for that, we need dynamic storage duration. So to do that, we use the new operator, which constructs a new object somewhere on the heap and returns a pointer to it. And then when we're done using it, we have to make sure that we use delete to destroy that object. And the lifetime is between, you know, when new is used to construct it and when delete is used to destroy it. In this example, we do both within the same function, but we could just as easily have, you know, had a function that, you know, constructs the object, maybe does some things with it, returns the pointer to it, and then the calling function destroys it. Just one note about initialization. So there's a number of ways to initialize things in C++. These are, I guess, the three main ones. They have names: copy initialization, direct initialization, brace initialization. They all do effectively the same thing. There's some, you know, edge cases where they're slightly different. Brace initialization is the new awesome one that has been added in C++ 11. In general, it doesn't really matter what you use as long as you know you should be consistent in your code. The braces with empty braces basically does what's called value initialization. So it, for integer and numeric types, it just initializes it to zero. For class types, it'll call the default constructor if there is one, or if there are no constructors, it'll initialize all the members. The reason that this is important is that local variables are not initialized by default in C++, so in C#, everything gets zero initialized, it's all happy and wonderful. In C++, this is not the case for local variables. It is for globals. So you can use the empty braces to initialize objects. Any questions? All right. So that brings us to RIII. Has anybody heard this acronym before? No, all right, that's good. Well, it's not good, but so RIII is an acronym for Resource Acquisition is Initialization. It's a terrible acronym. Everybody thinks it's a terrible acronym, but it's sort of stuck from the beginning. I'd prefer to call it scope-bound resource management. What this is it's the use of automatic variables, so function local variables, to manage resources. So for example, heap allocated memory or files or other sorts of things like that. So if we come back to our example here of dynamically allocating a my class and then we delete the pointer, and we can come up with a slightly simpler example perhaps. We just allocate a giant buffer. We don't want to put a whole megabyte on the stack, so we go and allocate it on the heap, and at the end of the function we'll use delete to destroy it. But there's a problem here. What if in that code, we have to throw an exception, or we call something that throws an exception, so the throw expression isn't there? Or what if, even something simpler, we're like, oh, well, we can bail out early, we don't need to do anything, we can just return. So in both of those cases, we've skipped the deletion and we've leaked that megabyte buffer, and so now we've got this meg sitting there that no one's going to clean up. There's no garbage collector to clean up after us. At first glance, what we'd really want is, we want, a finally block, so that we can go and guard this, or perhaps a using block, if we can tell using how to deal with this. In C++, we don't need either of those. We have something better. We can just use local variables. So if you remember, the destructor gets called when a variable when a local variable goes out of scope. So we can take advantage of that destructor to manage all of our resources for us. So in this case, we'll define a class scope buffer that basically owns that buffer. And when the scope buffer goes out of scope, it will clean it up automatically for us. And that'll happen regardless whether we return from the end of the function or return from the middle of the function or an exception unwinds through the function. Regardless, that destructor will get run. And it's actually quite easy to implement this. So here is the complete implementation of that scope buffer. So we have a constructor. It takes the pointer to the buffer and stores it internally. In the destructor, we just call delete to destroy the buffer like we would have before. We provide a get function because now we need to provide some way to access the buffer. We could also overload operators, to make it act like a pointer, and we'll see another type that does that in a little bit. We've made the copy and assignment operators deleted. What this does is it makes it impossible to copy this type. The reason that we do that is that if we were to make a copy of this and then we'd have two scope buffers that own the same buffer, then when each of them is destroyed, they'll both try to delete it, and that won't work because we need to, for every new, there has to be exactly one delete. We can't double delete something, or we'll probably corrupt the heap. So this is all there is to it, and then when we look at our code, we can declare this scope buffer, and we don't need to worry about managing the memory. You don't actually have to implement this yourself, though. There's a type in the C++ standard library that implements this for you. It's called unique putter. And unique putter has unique ownership of the pointer, so you can initialize it and then use it within that function. It actually does overload the operator, so you can just use asterisk to dereference it like you would an ordinary pointer. It also has the advantage that, so it's not copyable for the same reason that our scope buffer wasn't copyable. We don't want to have multiple copies owning this thing. But it is movable, and we won't talk about move semantics here, or it's basically a new C++11 feature that's very useful and powerful, but not in the basics category. But one nice thing is you can move it, so you can transfer ownership from one unique putter to another. So for example here, we can return a unique putter from a function. So this means that even at our function boundaries, we don't need to worry about, you know, raw pointers that, you know, the caller needs to take ownership of and needs to worry about deleting. We could just return a unique putter, and then they know, ah, okay, you know, I do own that, and this unique putter is responsible for cleaning it up. So C++ rule number one is never, ever use delete in your code. You should always use a smart pointer to manage dynamic lifetimes for objects. There are numerous smart pointers in the libraries that you can take advantage of, so there's unique putter. Sometimes you may need shared ownership, so you need multiple objects to all, you know, share ownership of another object, and for there you can use shared putter, which is basically, it does reference counting. For COM types, if you're dealing with COM interfaces, you can use COM putter, which has a whole bunch of extra helper things to do query interface safely, and other IO known based things. It also has handling for out parameters, which are common in COM. So the nice thing is that we're not going to just use RIII to manage memory resources. We can use it to manage basically anything. So as an example, we could imagine a function that, you know, has a mutex. It needs to take the mutex, do some work, and release the mutex. And so we might naively write it, you know, like this. We'll take the lock, do the code, and call unlock. In the library, there's a type unique lock that does exactly what we would expect it does. It takes the lock, and then in its destructor, it releases it. Similarly, you know, we might need to open a file, do some work, close the file. Again, there's a type, there's a C++ IO library that provides all of the RIII wrapping for you, so it'll automatically close the file and flush buffers when it goes out of scope. So I'll actually revise that rule number one, and I'll say you should never, ever manage resources manually in your C++ code. If you ever see a delete or an fclose, or if you're ever, you know, doing some kind of any kind of cleanup and it's not in a destructor, your code is probably, you know, far more brittle than it needs to be. It's probably going to cause maintenance problems in the future, because, you know, many years in the future, someone may add an early return or may go and tweak the code, and now suddenly that cleanup may get skipped. If it's in a destructor, it's very obvious that the code is not going to be skipped. Further, this helps you to write very linear code, because you don't need to worry about, you know, exiting via a single point. You can bail out at any time that you encounter an error, and everything you've done so far will get unwound. You should use existing container types where possible. So, you know, for example, we saw the, you know, the file and mutex and pointer types. There's many others that you can take a look at. We have a in the Windows SDK, there's a library called WRL. I think it's the Windows Runtime Library, but it's actually usable in ordinary desktop apps as well. And it has a set of handles for things like Windows file handles, you know, basically any kind of Windows handle and other related things. But you can easily write your own when necessary. Writing a simple scoped one that isn't movable, isn't copyable, as we saw, it fits on a slide. It's very easy to write. So it's, you know, there's no reason to make your code brittle and not do this. So now that you've seen this, does this look better than having to manage resources manually? Are there any questions about this technique? Because it's pretty awesome. Okay. So that's all I have for the basics of objects and RIII. But I do want to talk about containers and algorithms. So obviously in .NET, there's a very rich collections library, and there's Link, which provides, you know, a set of algorithms to operate on those collections. In C++, we have similar things. They're very syntactically different, but they're basically the same functionality. So we have a set of containers. We call them containers instead of collections, just for historic reasons. So this is a list of the most commonly used containers and their .NET equivalents. So we have a vector, which is basically equivalent to a .NET list. It's a dynamic array. There's also a std list, which is basically a linked list. I would advise against using it just because linked lists generally don't offer the performance characteristics that people expect. There's a set, which is basically a sorted set, and a map, which is a sorted dictionary. And then we have unordered containers also that work on hashing. And these are generic types, just like the generic .NET collections, so they can work with any particular type. Just like their .NET counterparts, there are similar operations. We call them by different names in some case. But generally, mapping from one to the other is fairly straightforward for basic things. So we'll take a look at just a few examples. So here we have a vector of integers. So it's just an ordered sequence of integers. They're stored in a dynamic array somewhere. The vector manages all the memory. You don't have to worry about memory management. So for example, if you were to continuously call pushback on the vector to keep adding elements to the end, it'll keep resizing under the covers for you. And we have a smart allocation scheme to try and reduce the number of allocations. You can iterate over the elements using indices for vector, because obviously if you have just an array of things, you can iterate over them using indices. And that's very straightforward, like we would see for C#. I won't go too much into the I/O, the way C++ I/O works, but basically inside the loop, we're just saying to the standard output, we'll write each value followed by a new line. So iteration with indices is not ideal, notably because most containers don't have the concept of indices. Obviously, arrays do. If you have a linked list, yes, you can certainly talk about indices because you can walk the list to find, for example, the 100th element. But if you're iterating over a linked list using indices, it's going to be much slower than you might expect because, you say, I want the element at index 100, and you've got to walk 100 places to find it. Then you say, okay, now I want the element at index 101, and you've got to walk, 101 places to find it. So you end up with an n-squared algorithm just to iterate over the elements. So every container in C++ exposes iterators, and the iterators provide access to the range of elements stored in the container. In some cases, they are ordered. So for example, for vector, they are insertion order because they're not insertion order. They're in the order that you put them in because it's just an array. For a set or a map, which are ordered containers, those will actually store them in a sorted order based on a comparer like operator less than. For containers like the unordered map and unordered set, those they can return you the sequence of elements, but they're not going to be in any particular order. They'll be however they're bucketed in the container. So this is an example of how we'll iterate over elements. There's another feature of C++ that I've demonstrated here, and that's auto. So just like there's var in C#, we have auto in C++. It works basically the same way as var does. It'll deduce the type from the initializer. In this case, the type is very long, which is why I've chosen to omit it. It's a std vector int, and then there's a nested type within it called const iterator that we would get from this. So again, the advantage of using iterators is that we can also iterate over, for example, a set, which has no concept of indices at all. Like there's not element number 5 in a set, there's just the elements. And we can do the same thing even for a map. So for example, if we initialize a map with a set of numbers, we can iterate over it. And the only thing that we've had to change in our loop is to account for the fact that we're storing pairs of values in the container. So when we iterate over it, we have both the key and the value that we have to extract, rather than just the value itself. We don't need to iterate over the entire container. You can actually perform arithmetic on iterators. So for example here, we obtain an iterator to the beginning of the container. We add 3 to it to get the sequence of 3 elements, and we just print those. So iterators are also what we use to access elements within the container. So we don't, because every C++ object is distinct, and we don't have we try to avoid reference semantics wherever possible. We don't have things like remove operation that goes through and removes all of the instances of a particular object, because in general there's no way for us to get that particular object without searching the map for it. So instead, Whenever we want to say we want to add, you know, we want to insert something after an element, or we want to remove an element from the list, we do so by finding, by getting an iterator to that element, and accessing the container that way. So, for example, here we can call erase, which removes an element from the list. So here we've removed the four from the list. We can use insert, and we can give it a position and say insert it, you know, between these two elements. We can get a value using iterators. So, you know, before we were looping over them, but you can just get an iterator and dereference it to get the value. The syntax here is very similar to pointers. So like we saw, you dereference a pointer to get the pointed to value. The same thing applies for iterators. You dereference the iterator to get the value. Iterators are a generalization of pointers, so most of the operations are common between them. Pointers are actually, at least conceptually, also iterators, so you can use them with the anything that we're discussing here as well. We can modify elements through iterators. One thing that you do have to be careful with, though, is there's nothing preventing you from forming iterators, you know, outside of the valid range. So, for example, in this last line of code, we try and access the 1,000th element, or 1,001th element, I guess, in the collection, which doesn't exist. In a retail build, in a release build with no debug checks enabled, this will probably just crash because you're going to be accessing memory outside of your bounds. So generally, you just need to be very careful to avoid this. There are many common programming errors here, though. So we have very extensive debugging checks. So this is one reason that C++ programs are often much slower during debugging or with debug builds than with release builds, is not only do we disable all the optimizations that the compiler performs, but we also enable a whole bunch of consistency checks, a whole bunch of correctness checks. So for example, this last line here would actually trigger a correctness check in the library, and so we would assert and say, hey, you've tried to do something invalid, to help you identify, you know, problem areas of your code. So this is another reason to avoid pointers and use iterators and containers, is that you get all those correctness checks for free, and they're only enabled in the debug builds. So, you know, in your retail build, you get blazing fast speed, everything is, you know, there's no checking done, but you can still debug things when you run into problems. So a common question that comes up, and this has been asked I don't even know how many times on Stack Overflow, is where are the common operations like sort and find? Like, how, if we have a vector of elements, how do we sort them? And people, of course, go and they're like, oh, I'll just, you know, call sort like I would on a list in .NET. And that doesn't work because there is no vector sort. The reason for this is that in the C++ library, the containers are implemented entirely separately from the algorithms as much as possible. So the reason for this is that it's generally the case that you can have different types of containers, and you can have different algorithms, like sort. And oftentimes, a single implementation of an algorithm will work with all sorts of different containers. So for example, if we wanted to implement an all-of algorithm that tested, you know, whether all of the elements in a container matched a particular predicate, like, there's no reason to implement that as a member of the container. There's no reason to, you know, have that on every single container. We can implement that once in terms of iterators and use it with all of the containers. So in general, the algorithms are not members of the containers. They're just implemented as non-members using generic programming. So we'll take a look at a few examples. They're generally very simple. So this is an example of sorting. So here we have a vector, it doesn't have sorted elements. We pass the sort algorithm, the iterators, to the range that we want to sort, and it does the sorting. If that wasn't a vector, if it was a deck, for example, is another random access container, we could use that. If it's an array, we can sort that using the same algorithm. It'll use the same implementation under the hood. Similarly, if we want to find an element, there's a find algorithm that can be used, and so we pass it the element that we'd like to find in the range. If it doesn't find the element, it returns that end iterator. So one feature of these of iterator ranges is that they're closed on the beginning end and open on the end. So, for example, the beginning iterator will be pointing at the 1 in the vector, and then the end iterator will be pointing past the 6. So you can iterate, basically, instead of iterating until less than or equal to the end, you iterate until you equal the end. So this makes it a bit easier to implement a lot of the algorithms. A lot of loops become much simpler. And of course, if the find algorithm does find the element, it returns an iterator to it, so you could remove it or do whatever you need to do with it. Similarly, if you have a sorted collection, we have a binary search algorithm. It returns a Boolean to say, ah, yes, that element is in the container, or it's not in the container. There's a whole bunch of algorithms. So these are some of the most commonly used that I've seen in code. There's many more. I could probably fill several slides just with the standard ones. Now, some of these algorithms, like for each, don't operate just on the container. They actually take an operation that they need to perform, you know, with particular elements. So in the case of for each, it iterates over the range and calls a function with each element. In order to do that, C++, we have lambda expressions. This is a new feature in C++ 11. We've implemented them in Visual C++ since Visual Studio 2010, so they've been around for a while. They're very similar to C-sharp lambdas. Obviously, they're not syntactically similar. This looks quite different. But in terms of, you know, they're just anonymous, unnamed functions. So in this case, you know, we can pass a lambda here, and we can use this for each, and basically this just prints all the elements just like our for loop did before. That's not a particularly interesting algorithm. But we could think of the transform algorithm, which takes two ranges. So, you know, it takes a source range and then a destination range that is unbounded, so we assume that there's enough elements there. And we can perform an operation and return the new value that'll be inserted into the output range. So here, for example, we square all of the elements in the array and we store them back into the original array. We don't have to store them into the original array, though. We could store them into any particular collection. So here, you know, we initialize a vector, and we basically store the squares into the W vector instead. The one problem here is that it requires that W be large enough to hold all of these elements, because if it's not, then it's going to iterate off the end of the collection. And so we also have in the standard library some iterator adapters. So there's this one called backInserter that when you write to it, it actually calls pushback. So it pushes elements onto the back of the container. So this makes it possible to very safely implement code like this, where, you know, you're reading elements from one container and trying to write them out to another one. You can just have the algorithm call pushback and keep inserting new elements as it needs to. So you don't have to, you know, manually make sure there's enough room in the container. As another example, you know, if we wanted to sort elements in reverse, so by default we use less than to sort things so that they get sorted in you know, the correct order. If we wanted to sort them in reverse, so we would have 654321 here, we could just write a lambda expression that does a greater than comparison instead of a less than comparison. And as a final algorithm example, you know, if we want to test that all of the elements in a collection match a certain predicate, there's an all of algorithm for that. Iterators can also be used to interop between containers. So for example, all of the containers have a range constructor that takes an iterator range and then copies all those elements into the container. So in this case, you know, we have a vector of integers and we want to, you know, put them all into a set. Instead, we can do that just by passing the iterator range from the vector into the set. The last point I want to make about this is that pointers are also iterators. So if you have an array, with an array, you can get a pointer to each element, and if you increment that pointer, you'll get the pointer to the next element. So these work just like iterators into containers. So you can use them also with, you know, algorithms like sort. If we wanted to sort this array, we can do so. In this case, because an array is in a class, it doesn't have member functions begin and end, but the standard library provides overloads for begin and end that you can use to get access to them. Similarly, if you have a function and it actually just takes a pointer and a number of elements that are, you know, present in the array, then you can compute your own iterators using addition on that with that count and the pointer, and then sort that way. So you're not limited to, you know, the containers in the standard library or to the algorithms in the standard library. You can actually implement your own. So I'm going to show a very simple example. of the all of algorithm that we looked at before. So this is the entire algorithm, all on one slide. So it's a template, which is somewhat like a generic in C sharp, except in C sharp and .NET, generics need to be constrained, you know, so that arguments implement a particular interface. In C++, generic programming is done with duck typing. So duck typing is, you know, basically from the phrase that if it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck and looks like a duck, then it probably is a duck. So basically, rather than requiring that containers or iterators implement a particular interface, we just say, okay, does it have the required operations? So in this case, the only operations that we require are that we can increment the iterator here at the end of here in the for loop, and that we can dereference it to get a value. So as long as, you know, the type provides those two operations, you know, we can work with it. So that's what allows us to work with, you know, vector iterators or set iterators or, you know, whatever. One of the key advantages here is that because we don't need to use interfaces, there's no virtual functions. So all of the generic generic functions like this all of we can inline all of those iterator calls very easily because we don't have to worry about, you know, making indirect calls to virtual functions. So this is a substantial performance benefit for C++. So in this algorithm, our template takes two different types, and so basically you can call this with any, you know, types there, and as long as they meet the requirements, it'll instantiate correctly. We take an iterator and a function, which is the function that we call. Then we just iterate over the collection like we did before and test each element, and if the function returns false, then, you know, we return false from this. Otherwise, we return true. So that's sort of a whirlwind overview to the STL. I think the most important thing to note here is that we have a lot of containers, we have a lot of abstractions, it's not necessarily to roll your own. It's very common, something that I've seen very commonly is people just like to dynamically allocate arrays and go and do their own buffer manipulation, and in general that's the wrong thing to do. That these containers are very easy to use, they're very easy to use correctly, and they help eliminate most of the most complex code from applications. So are there any questions about the containers and algorithms? All right. So I want to mention just a couple of assorted features, to do that. The first is references. So we saw pointers are one form of indirection in C++, and they come from C, and there are a lot of benefits to them. Another form of indirection is references. And a reference basically lets you bind a new name to a different object or to an existing object. So for example here, we have an integer x, and we bind a reference named rx to that object. And so in this case, rx just becomes another name for x. We don't need to, you know, use the asterisk to dereference it. We don't need to do anything like that. It's just a new name for the object. This is particularly useful for functions. So for example, this function, rather than taking the vector by value, so if it were to take the vector by value and not by reference, we'd actually make a copy of that, because like we saw before, when you initialize one object from another object, it's going to make a copy by default. So here, if we don't want to make that copy, because maybe there's a billion elements in the vector and we don't want to, you know, copy all that data around just for this function call, we can pass it by reference. Again, the important thing is that it's still very explicit. We still have the ampersand that tells us, oh, by the way, there's, you know, indirection going on here. The second important feature that I'll mention is const. So const basically allows you to say that something cannot be modified via a name. So here, you know, we declare the integer x as const, so it's not possible to give it a new value. Const also works for pointers and references. So here, x is not const, like the actual integer, you know, the int variable is not const. So we can still assign via const pointer that each refer to it. And in both of those cases, we cannot modify the object through that reference or pointer because the reference and pointer are declared const. This is a very important part of C++ interfaces. It's called const correctness. Is that if a function takes something by reference, or it takes a pointer to something, and it's not going to modify that object, then it should take a, you know, a const reference or a const pointer to tell the caller, oh, by the way, you know, I'm going to take this by reference, but I'm not going to mutate it. So you don't need to worry about, you know, me doing anything funny with it. There are ways, so there's a common complaint that const is, you know, you can actually work around it. Like there's a const cast that lets you remove constness. But in general, nobody uses that, you know, incorrectly, or no good code should use it incorrectly. So this is a very useful feature despite certain holes in the language. We have a range for. This is very similar to the C# for each, except we just spell it a little differently. That double ampersand is an R value reference, but we don't need to discuss the details. This is just the form that all of the range for loops should use. And then, like I mentioned before, we have a auto that is basically like a C# var. It's spelled auto because the auto keyword was present in C++ from all the way back in the beginning, but it didn't actually have any useful meaning, so it was repurposed for this. So in this case, the stuff is of type vector of int. So again, I haven't been able to get through, you know, all of the features of C++, obviously, or all of the best practices. It's a very large language. I think this book is 800 pages or something like that. So I'd strongly recommend, you know, getting a good book and as a resource. Other good references, Stack Overflow has a C++ FAQ that I highly recommend. The questions are all tagged C++-FAQ, and it's been curated by a bunch of the senior contributors there. So that's another great place to look for, you know, common pitfalls in C++ and programming errors. So are there any questions about C++ before we dive into some examples of how to do interop with C#? Awesome, okay. So there's a number of, you know, if we have a component or we're writing something in C++, we want to be able to, you know, consume that from a C# program or from, you know, any .NET language, really. And there's a number of ways to do that. So we're going to look at three here. One of them is pinvoke. How many people have used pinvoke before? Some people. Okay. C++ CLI is another option, and we'll take a look at that. And then for store apps, both Windows Store and Windows Phone, WinRT is also an option. And so we'll take an example, or we'll take a look at a Windows Store example in particular. There is a fourth option, which is COM, and I'm not going to show a COM example today. I did not think I would have enough time to go through all the intricacies of COM. So before we dive in my example, I'm going to use a C++ library that my team at Microsoft is responsible for called AMP, Accelerated Massive Parallelism. And this is a library for implementing data parallelism in C++. So if you have a collection of, you know, a billion elements and you want to, for example, square each of the elements, this library will look at the hardware you have available on your computer, and it will use whatever hardware is best suited for this task. Obviously, squaring the elements is, you know, a very simple example. There are many much more complex things that you can do. So the cool thing is that it enables code that is basically C++ code. So it looks just like normal C++. There are some restrictions due to actual hardware restrictions. But that C++ code can actually run on your graphics GPU or on CPU vector units if you have SSE on your CPU, which I expect everyone here does. Our implementation is based on DirectX 11, but it's an open standard, and there are at least two other implementations in the works that are based on CUDA and other things for other platforms. So I've picked this as an example because this is one of the key examples of, you know, a performance, you know, benefit that you might get from C++. There's no equivalent for this yet, you know, in .NET. So I thought this would make a nice example. So, time for some demos. I have here, unfortunately, I can't see the screen, so I'm going to have to fumble through it a little bit. So I have here, I've actually created all the projects already because I didn't think anyone would want to see me typing up here on the screen. We'll start off with just a very simple pinvoke example. So in this case, we have a C++ library. I hope the font is plenty large. So we have this C++ library, and it uses AMP. We define a structure, a vector 3D, which is basically just a three-dimensional vector with x, y, and z components. And then we define a function called compute length that will basically iterate over this entire, iterate over an array of vectors, and will compute the length of each and store that into a result array. So it takes as its inputs, it takes an array of vector 3Ds, it takes an array of result values, and then it takes the number of elements in those arrays. Ordinarily, I would not necessarily recommend using pointers here, but for interop, generally using raw pointers to arrays is the easiest way to interop via pinvoke with C# and other languages. So then, in here, we basically just use this algorithm called parallel for each that will iterate over the vector in parallel. So if you have an enormous collection, it'll actually go and compile this into an accelerator on the GPU, and it'll go and run this and run all of the computations in parallel. And this just computes the length of each vector and stores them back. So I then have a C# console app. I'm a libraries developer, so I'm not really into user interfaces. And in the C# console app, we've wrapped up this export. So we've defined our own copy of vector 3D, and it's basically the same. It has a set of three double fields. We've specified that it's layout kind sequential so that it matches the correct C++ layout. There's all sorts of options for specifying structure layout. There are many pitfalls with pinvoke you'll need to be very careful with. But generally, this is fairly straightforward. We then DLL import from the compute length function from the C++ DLL. I've used here as an example that so in my C++ library, I use the fairly common C++ convention of using all lowercase letters and an underscore. And in .NET, usually we use Pascal case. And so I've shown that you can remap the .NET name to another name simply by using this entry point attribute. So then in our main function, we create a vector of these an array of these vector 3D objects. In this case, they're just a unit vector, and then 2 and 3. We create an array to hold the results, and then we call the native function to do the actual computations. So if we run this, I think this is the startup project. Yep. And we can see it computed the results. I won't run the other ones because this is difficult. So there's a couple of things that I will note here. The first is that the configuration names for C++ projects and managed projects are not the same. So in managed, x86 is used for target-specific x86 code. In C++, we use Win32 for historical reasons that go back decades. So you'll need to be careful with that. The second thing that you'll need to know, to create the C++ project, I actually just created an empty project. And in the properties, I changed the configuration type from XE to DLL, so that's all you need to do to build a DLL instead. In the actual C++ code, the only thing we needed to do to annotate this function as an actual export that could be called from .NET is to add this decalspec DLL export. I've also used an explicit calling convention here. So on x86 and now x64 also, there are multiple calling conventions in C++, and these are how arguments get pushed onto the stack and how the return value is returned. One common mistake when using pinvoke or calling into C++ is having mismatched calling conventions. So in this case, it's always best to use an explicit calling convention, so std call here. And then in the C# code, we also specify std call. Finally, in the C++ code, I've made the function extern C. And what this does is it gives the function C++ or C language linkage. In C++, because you can overload functions, we can't just name this function as compute lengths in the DLL. It actually has to be compute lengths, and then the compiler has to encode all of the parameter types as part of the function name so that the linker can pick the right right overload at link time. By using extern C, we're saying, let's export this as a C function. And so instead, it doesn't get any C has no overloads, no overloading, so it just gets exported using the normal C name, compute lengths. There's one other thing I had to do to make this work. In order to find this DLL at runtime, the DLL needs to be in the same directory as the XE, or it needs to be in one of a well-specified set of directories. But during development, the easiest thing is to do it is to put it into the same directory. So the easiest thing to do is to edit the C# project manually, yes, and add a new item that references the actual DLL that's getting built, and just say have it be copied to the output directory during build. You'll also need to set up, you know, any project dependencies to make this work. If you have a DLL that's already been built and you're just trying to use it from C#, you obviously don't need to worry about this. You just need to make sure you've copied it to the right place. Oops. So there's one other thing I wanted to mention here, and it's about performance. So you'll see in when we imported the compute lengths function, we used arrays for our parameter types. And the CLR, you know, when it actually thunks from managed to native code, it will go and it will marshal those arrays for you. So it'll, in this case, it will actually copy the array of vectors into some other location so that the garbage collector doesn't go and move it around. Because obviously, if you're in native code and then the garbage collector runs on the managed side and moves the data, you're not going to know because the native code is not garbage collector aware. If you have a large amount of data, that copying during marshaling can be very expensive. The CLR does have some optimizations to reduce the amount of copying. So for example, if you have just an array of doubles, it will actually pin that in memory automatically for you. It does not appear to do that for the vector 3D, though I'm not a CLR expert, so I can't comment. I just know that there was a major performance benefit when we changed this. So I have another version of this C# program, and the only difference is we now use we now import it as an unsafe function, and we use pointers. So this, of course, requires us in our main function to use fixed to fix those buffers into memory, and then call the underlying implementation. So this will prevent copies from being made of the or unnecessary copies of the data from being made. The second option for interop that we have, I have one more pinvoke example. So let's say instead of having just a single function, we have actually a C++ class that we want to export. So I have a very simple class, and it's a fast multiplier. And so this class, you can construct it with a single double value, we store that, and then we provide a function named multiply. It takes an array of data, and it multiplies each of those elements in place by the multiplier value. The implementation of that multiply function is quite simple. You know, it's basically the same thing we saw before, except that we multiply the data in place and we multiply it by the multiplier rather than doing the square root to compute the vector length. We can't just export this C++ class easily for use by C#. So like I said, anything C++ that we export, you know, gets names that are mangled and funny looking because the compiler has to encode information like what class something came from and what parameters it has. So in order to use pinvoke with this, we actually need to write a C wrapper around this class. And that is not particularly difficult. So here's what the C wrapper looks like. So we provide three functions. One of them is fast multiplier create that will do the construction of a fast multiplier and return a pointer to it. We provide a fast multiplier destroy that actually does the destruction of it. And then we provide a fast multiplier multiply that, you know, does that wraps the actual multiplication operation. And these simply delegate to the C++ the member functions of these. So we use new to allocate a new fast multiplier. We specifically use the non-throwing new so that if this fails, it'll return null so that we can handle that error in the C# code. In the destruction function, we just delete the multiplier. Now, I know I said before that you should never use delete outside of a destructor, but in this case, it's solely for interop purposes. So this function, while it's not actually a destructor, it serves the same function as a destructor. And then in the multiply, we just call multiply on the provided multiplier. So in the C#, I wrap this in the C# side using a class. So we provide a constructor for our class that actually calls the imported fast multiplier create. We provide a multiply function that does the pinning of the data and calls the actual exported multiply. And then we implement idisposable to handle the destruction of the native object. The exports are the imports from the DLL are largely the same as they were in the other one. And then here in our main function we use using to make sure it gets correctly destroyed as we would expect. And the results here are as we would expect. I won't run the program. So this works fairly well, but it can be very cumbersome, especially if you have large classes or a lot of classes, to have to write all of these wrappers manually. Both on the C++ side and on the C# side. So in desktop apps, and I have to be very clear about this, C++ CLI is a solution that only works in desktop apps. You cannot use it in Windows Store or Windows Phone apps. You can use C++ CLI. So C++ CLI is a set of language extensions to C++ that basically lets you mix managed and native code all in C++. So in this case, we have the same multiplier. There's no differences to the actual multiplier code. And then we have a wrapper around it, which is I've basically moved our fast multiplier implementation from the C# into the C++. And the core advantage of this is that we don't need to write all of the pinvoke for it because there is no pinvoke required. So here in our fast multiplier, we basically, we do the construction just like we did in the C#. If the allocation failed, then we'll throw an out-of-memory exception. So we do the translation from C++ failures into CLR exceptions to make this better for clients. We implement our multiply. The pin putter is basically like fixed, sort of like fixed in C#. It allows us to pin data in memory, and then we can call the multiply function to actually do the multiplication. And then this pattern here is basically the C++ CLI equivalent of the idisposable pattern in C# and other .NET languages. Because C++ CLI tries to bridge the gap between C++ and .NET, you can actually use automatic variable semantics for managed types, just like you can with native types from within C++ CLI. So there's some semantic differences. I will note that C++ CLI is very complex. It's easy to use incorrectly in many cases. So the biggest problem that it has is that it's very easy to start using it all over in your code base, and then you forget that you're bridging two different object models that you have on the one hand, the managed object model, and on the other hand, the native object model. So if you do choose to use C++ CLI, it's best to keep it as a thin wrapper around your actual native code, and then just to expose it to other managed code. On the managed side, this looks largely like it did before, except we don't need any of the wrapping code. We can simply construct the new fast multiplier, call multiply, and we're done. We don't need to do any of the magic in C#. It's all done in C++ CLI. So like I said, this doesn't work with WinRT. But with WinRT, we have something better. So with WinRT, we have the advantage that there's one common ABI that's shared by all of the languages using WinRT. And this allows us to implement, for example, a component using C++ that can be consumed from either JavaScript or C# or Visual Basic or any other language, another C++ component even. on the C++ side, this can be completely native code, so you don't need to, you know, write any adapter layer. You can just write your types like you normally would, with a little bit of native wrapping around it. So here I've implemented a C++ CX type, again called fast multiplier. And you'll note, so one thing I didn't explain with C++ CLI is that manage types cannot contain as a member any actual just native class types. So we couldn't just have our native fast multiplier be a data member of our manage type. We had to use a pointer. And the reason for that is that manage types can be moved around in memory by the garbage collector, and native types, the address is actually significant. So here we don't need to worry about that. Or we wouldn't need to worry about that, but in this case, I've just implemented it directly as members of the C++ CX type. So we provide a multiply just like we did before. And on the C# side, all we need to do is add a reference to that, and then we can use it. You don't need to do any of the interop work. It's kind of like magic under the hood. So literally, we can just construct the fast multiplier, and WinRT and the WinRT metadata handles all of the work for us. So are there any questions about any of these demos and techniques? Okay. If I can find my mouse. So to recap, the most important thing to take away from this is that there's no garbage collector to clean up after you in C++, but we have something better. We have resource acquisition as initialization, the RAII idiom. You still don't have to worry too much about memory management in C++, because again, you should be using this everywhere to manage resources. And in many cases, it's often easier to manage things more easily than in C#. You don't have to go and implement iDisposable for every type. You can just, you know, you can compose very easily these RAII types, and things tend to just work. So that's all I've got. I think there's a way to give feedback on here. So if you really hated this, please go and say that, so that, you know, I get that feedback. And if there's any questions, I'm happy to chat afterwards or answer them now. And otherwise, thanks for coming.